Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Thank you for joining us. I am Joe Matthew in Washington. Kaylee Lyons is off today, and it has been a very busy one. If you look at the president's schedule, he's got a lot going on, not a lot of specifics, but policy meetings and executive time, as they call it. All of them are closed press, but we've heard from Donald Trump repeatedly today on social media, and mostly since 10 a.m. when the Supreme Court began a series of rulings, many of which we have been waiting weeks and months for, including a ruling on Lisa Cook. And the president has been quick to acknowledge many of these on social media since they first dropped. First of all, we'll get to the headlines. Lisa Cook can keep her job for now. We did learn that shortly after 10 a.m. That does not mean she will always have it, as the court also allows some time for this period to expire here in the investigation into her alleged mortgage fraud that brought us to this point. Until that cause is determined, though, she will be able to keep her job. With the president writing on Truth Social, the Cook lawsuit having to do with her suitability in sitting on the board of the Federal Reserve was sent back by the Supreme Court on a strictly procedural basis. He says, we will take appropriate action immediately to make sure that someone who has committed wrongdoing will not be making vital decisions concerning the welfare of the United States of America. And the president writes that while the court rules simultaneously that his power to fire top government officials is in fact being expanded in the eyes of the court, a 6-3 decision overturning a 1935 precedent, laying the legal groundwork for what we consider the modern administrative state. This is the Rebecca Kelly Slaughter case, FTC, allowing the president to fire the FTC member despite a law saying commissioners can be removed only for cause. We get to the bottom of all of this now, ahead of a busy hour with Tyler Kendall, our Washington correspondent, who's typically posted up at the White House, has gone to the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue to the Supreme Court to bring us the latest on all of this. Tyler, walk through these decisions and what this specifically means for Lisa Cook as the investigation continues.
Well, Joe, these are two very highly consequential decisions, but neither was necessarily surprising, right? We got these indications during the oral arguments for both of these cases that they were probably going to end up this way. In one sense, a major win for the administration when it comes to bolstering the president's ability to fire the heads of independent agencies. It's really considered to be a blockbuster ruling. But then on the other, we saw the Supreme Court move to establish and ensure the independence of the central bank by allowing Fed Governor Lisa Cook to stay in her seat. Now, we've heard from President Trump on both of these cases, as you mentioned, happy about one, not necessarily about the other. But I wanted to highlight some of the other people that we heard from when it comes to Lisa Cook's case, and that's the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts here, who joined with Brett Kavanaugh, another conservative justice, with the other liberal justices. This ruling was 5-4, and he said that essentially they took issue with the process here, that Lisa Cook wasn't given the due process that she deserved to respond to the allegations against her, saying in part, quote, under our precedents, Cook was entitled to notice and some opportunity to respond prior to her termination. You'll recall we all learned about this months ago, where we saw the allegations posted on Truth Social and then a few days later her termination letter posted. But I wanted to bring up another thread that we've been following really closely here, which is that the Chief Justice added, quote, monetary policy should not be subject to political interference. So while the court did not decide on whether or not the allegations against Lisa Cook would rise to the level of her firing, it is very clear here from this decision, from what we actually heard in their line of questioning back in January during the oral arguments, that the Supreme Court was thinking about what's known as the equities of the case, what those longer term impacts could be when it comes to the economy and the central bank's independence.
got it. Really interesting, Tyler, and it's remarkably quiet over at the court. Usually we have a major ruling, and you can hear the protesters behind Tyler, but it just reminds us of how esoteric these cases are. It's a big deal for us at Bloomberg, big deal for the markets, maybe not a kitchen table issue for Americans. Tomorrow might be different, though, Tyler. Birthright citizenship, we're going to find out one way or the other at 10 a.m., says the court.
Yep, this is the last day of the term tomorrow, where we're waiting on four very consequential cases, including when it comes to birthright citizenship. Now, you'll recall, and I mentioned this last hour, I was here in this very spot back in April for those oral arguments because President Trump was here, too. He became the first sitting president in U.S. history to attend oral arguments in person. That is how critical this case is to the Trump administration's immigration agenda. Now, if the signals that we got about these cases turned out to be true, that could be true tomorrow. We're also expecting the justices to be highly wary of the Trump administration's bid to end automatic birthright citizenship. They seemed to take some issue with the Trump administration's arguments here. In fact, the chief justice during oral argument said that their legal argument was, quote, quirky. But they're essentially trying to say that the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment should not be applied so broadly, whereas we've seen the challengers to that executive order that President Trump signed on day one say that this is longstanding legal precedent, and it seems the court may go that way. You'll recall the Chief Justice at the time said that it is a new world, but it is the same Constitution. Joe, it has very wide-ranging impacts. It stands to impact the nearly 255,000 children that are born to undocumented immigrants in this country every year.
It'll be another awfully important ruling tomorrow, and something tells me Tyler will be back at the Supreme Court. Thank you, Tyler Kendall. Of course, we add the voice of Mick Mulvaney, and we're going to be talking later on this hour with Elizabeth Wydra from the Constitutional Accountability Center to talk about the legal significance here. We want to talk about the political significance with a voice that we haven't heard from in a bit. Mick Mulvaney, of course, former acting White House Chief of Staff, co-founder Freedom Caucus, former OMB director, former acting CFPB director. Clad in seersucker today. You look great.
If you can't wear seersucker in D.C. in July, when can you wear it?
It's going to be 100 degrees in 2 days. I think you're smarter than I am right now. But welcome back.
That would be a first, but I'll take it.
I don't know if that's true. The president of the United States, I'm guessing, is calling a lot of people this morning. He's not happy. We haven't even mentioned the mail-in ballot component.
Yeah,
that was
one.
A whole separate ruling as well. With regard to Lisa Cook, though, did the president just find the line, the Fed's simply different than any other agency?
Yeah. And if I wanted to, I could see both sides of this one. If I want to take the side of the court on this one, if you go back historically, and I've not read the opinion. I just got into town. Money supply has always been different. Congress always had the right to run the printing presses. That was their job. It was not an executive authority. So if the court looks at this and says, well, you know what, regulation is one thing, the FTC is another, my own CFPB is something else, those are executive functions. Yeah. The monetary policies of the country were always congressional authority, so maybe that's different, and maybe that was the basis for this decision. Now, I just heard something from your report that was struck me as completely wrong, which is that monetary policy should not be subject to political influence.
How about that line?
Really?
That's
what?
From the Chief Justice.
Yeah,
Mike.
That scares the hell out of me.
Why?
Because everything should be respond to political pressures in this country. So who's going to make ultimately, who does the Supreme Court think gets to make monetary policy? A bunch of people that we don't elect? That is really frightening to me. Hmm. If it was Congress's right in the beginning under the Constitution, they're subject to political pressure. Why wouldn't we still have that? I worry about these decisions that say, well, there's certain things that are just bigger than politics. They're above politics. We have to make things, take them
away from
politics.
Knowing that elected officials must confirm people for the Fed, therefore...
Yeah, that's fine. There's some political input there.
Yeah.
The terms could maybe are subject to political pressure. But look, I dealt with this at the CFPB. It was created by Elizabeth Warren because she thought that consumer protection should be above politics. Mm-hmm. Once you start going down that road, think about all the things in our government that really should be above politics and really should be left to the professionals, left to the technocrats. That frightens me. So anyway, I think that sentence may come back to haunt conservatives 100 years from now.
Wow.
I still think this is probably the right decision.
If in fact, it is found that Lisa Cook did commit mortgage fraud.
Yeah.
Does that line then keep her from being fired that day?
I don't know how it can be. Huh. If this is different and it's based on the fact that it used to be originally in Congress, yeah. that again, now it's apparently above politics, then what would be the justification for letting a president fire somebody? Why wouldn't an impeachment be the ordinary process to remove a person for those types of causes?
Fascinating.
I think it's the right decision, but apparently, don't get me wrong. If it comes, I'm not like some people in my party.
Yeah.
I recognize the fact I don't know everything about everything.
Okay.
So
fine.
I don't lecture the Pope on theology. I'm not going to lecture John Roberts on constitutionality.
Okay. This other ruling though says you can fire pretty much anybody else.
Yeah, and that's the right decision.
Yeah.
And Humphrey's executor was wrong when it was written 100 years ago or 85, whatever it was. And I think it was Roberts who actually said that.
You long believed that? Is this something that's been knocking around your head?
Yeah, this whole idea that there is this part of government in the executive branch, especially, that's not subject to the president, makes no sense. If we want the president to be the chief executive officer of the country, and that's the position, they should be able to hire, fire, do all the things that executives are supposed to do. Yeah. There shouldn't be these independent agencies. I don't have my pocket constitution because I'm not that geeky anymore. I used to be. I would challenge anybody
really disappointed.
To show me where the branch of government called independent agencies is.
Yeah.
It's not
We don't have those. Yeah. So is there like a Monday night massacre in the offing then, or there just aren't that many people he wants to fire anyway?
Yeah, look.
He's largely created the government he wants.
Let's step back and take maybe a more holistic view of this. Mm-hmm. I worry about the rise of populism. I really do, on both the left and the right.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons populism exists is that people keep voting and they don't see any difference. They vote left, left wins. We don't really go that far left. They vote right wins. We don't go over that far right. The government has not been responsive to the voters, in large part because of the structure of the government. I have no difficulty with elections having consequences. Uh-huh. It's one of the reasons I don't like the filibuster rule in the Senate, but that's another story. Hmm. Presidents should be able to hire and fire people in their executive branch in order to put their policies into place. That's what they got elected to do. You might not like it, especially if you're a Democrat now. You don't like it because it's Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I certainly wouldn't have liked it from a policy standpoint under Biden, but it's the right way to run the country. So if there's a house cleaning, yeah, probably so. But if you put people in that want to put the Trump policies in place, and you know I've talked long times about the deep state and how real it is, maybe this is sort of a light at the end of the tunnel.
Wow. The mail-in ballots ruling is significant.
Yeah.
As long as it's postmarked by election, it can be counted after election day. Mm-hmm. So when the election is complete, I think the words that were used here. What does this mean for the Save America Act or some of the other attempts the president's made to cut down on mail-in ballots?
Yeah, again, I think it's probably the right decision because traditionally we've allowed states to run their own elections in this country. Don't like it. Don't like the fact that it takes California 7.5 weeks to count or something absurd like that.
Yeah.
But unless you have a federal law sitting on top of it, then I think it's probably the right decision. Mm-hmm. I still don't see a pathway for success for the SAVE Act. Mm-hmm. I don't really understand why. I know there's some complaints about it in terms of I have my passport. You might have yours. A lot of folks don't.
Sure.
How do you really prove citizenship, especially on the day of an election, those types of things? I don't like things that discourage people from voting once and voting legally. Mm-hmm. I like the bill generally, but everybody I talk to on the Hill says the votes simply aren't there for a variety of reasons, and that doesn't change if it's in budget reconciliation, if it's tied to funding, if it's tied to anything. I just don't see the pathway to success.
Well, you must be chuckling, or I don't know what you're doing, looking at what's that. You've got the floor held hostage by Ana Paulina Luna. You've got a Freedom Caucus. Chip Roy's not going to behave in this Rules Committee meeting today. Are we done? Is the store closed indefinitely here?
Oh, probably, but it was anyway. It's Joe. It's come on. It's almost 4th of July
weekend. I understand, sure. But, okay, there was one bill that got out before they locked the doors.
What did I miss?
Well, this housing bill.
I don't understand why he didn't sign it in the first place. And again, he didn't say he was going to veto it.
Right.
He said he wasn't going to sign it. So even if he does nothing for the next, 8 days now?
Uh-huh.
It becomes law.
Yeah.
Look, there's parts of the bill I don't like. That's the nature of a compromise. I don't like the part that bans corporations from owning houses. Mm-hmm. I think that's a market distortion. But I also understand the price you have to pay to get a bill done. If I was going to be critical of my good friend Tim Scott, it was the language that he used when he says, houses are for people, not for corporations. That's populist demagogy. demagoguery, and I really don't like it. If you come out and say, look, I don't like this as a policy, I think it distorts the market, but it's what we needed to do in order to get this larger package passed. That's the nature of compromise in Washington. That is a mature way to look things. It doesn't sort of muddy the waters about the, about what the role of corporations are. I worry about blaming corporations for our ills.
Well, you know, but a lot of our analysis here has found that this institutional ownership is really, I mean, we're really nibbling around the edges.
It is a nothing burger.
It doesn't really exist.
It is, and that's why it would be completely defensible to come out and say, look, it's not going to be that big a deal. It's not going to, but it was the price we had to pay to get all these other good policies.
Yeah.
People understand a compromise. We do it in our own families every single day.
Sure, yeah.
So, but look, it's a decent bill. There's like 45 different provisions that some of it could actually help a little bit. I don't think it's going to help much because it doesn't get to the real root cause, which is that towns and counties don't approve enough housing. But it's a good bill. I don't know why the president decided to sort of fight on this hill.
They had Stat Hall all dressed up.
I know. I saw
signing
that.
Ceremony. Oh, my God. Last one. High-minded question for Mick Mulvaney.
Oh, my goodness. The other one's low-minded?
You mentioned, well, all this has been so far, right? You mentioned some of the bigger political themes that are happening here, and you were on the ground floor for the Tea Party.
Yeah.
You see what's happening. The president calls them communists, socialist Democrats. We've got another contest in Colorado tomorrow that is really starting to bring this outside of Manhattan. If you look at Maine, if you look at Michigan, Colorado, and California. Are we witnessing the birth of a new type of Tea Party on the left?
That's exactly what this is.
Yeah.
And you and I may have talked about this. They're about, the Democrats are about 10 years behind us on this, in large part because of the tremendous leadership that Nancy Pelosi and along with her Barack Obama exercised over their parties. Hmm. They had a lot more control over their party. And just naturally, Democrats are better team players than Republicans. We're a little bit more individualistic on our side of the aisle. So we were a little bit ahead of them in sort of this Freedom Caucus evolution. Mm-hmm. They're just catching up. Their populist wing is now catching up. They're getting ready to go through their Donald Trump primary. Wait and see who runs in 2028, who's their Donald Trump, because I think you're going to see it. But the parties continue to fracture. It's probably not surprising. We're a country of 350 million people with only two parties. They were never going to be monolithic in the first place.
Yeah, right.
But if you want to see the way the Democrats going, go back and start studying the Republican Party starting about 2008, 2009, and you'll see the same, what is it, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme?
Well, it's rhyming here. Yeah. It's just a question of whether this, in fact, continues to snowball around the country, if it's something, as we mentioned, that's limited to downtown Manhattan. Mick, it's great to see you. Welcome
back. It's always
a
pleasure.
Happy Seersucker Day a little late, and happy 4th of July.
Every day is a Seersucker.
Happy America's birthday. It is going to be this week. 90s tomorrow. 100, they said, by Thursday. Good Lord. Mick Mulvaney was, of course, Donald Trump's acting chief of staff in the first term. Spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill. Helped to co-found the Freedom Caucus. And great, Mick, to have you back. We thank you. As we reassemble our political panel to pick up on some of the things that we just talked about with Mr. Mulvaney. Rick Davis is here, a Bloomberg politics contributor, Republican strategist, partner at Stone Court Capital. And Frederick Hicks, Democratic strategist, founder, CEO, Hicks Evaluation Group. Gentlemen, it's great to have you both with us. What do you think about that, Rick? Some of these elections, and we'll talk about it a lot tomorrow with regard to the primary in California, start making you wonder if this is, in fact, a national story, not a New York story. Are Democrats recruiting for their own Tea Party or their own Freedom Caucus right now?
Well, there's no question there's been an internal fight going on with Democrats, both in the primaries, but also on party control. The left has been the insurgent ideology. And Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden and people like that who really represent the center of the Democratic Party have been fighting it off for a long time. I would say Hakeem Jeffries hasn't been much of a bulwark against it and has kind of let the caucus do their own thing in the House, which breeds a little bit of that. But there's no question there's a bit of a surge to the left. But I would say over the long period of time, the parties that are successful are the ones that migrate back to the center.
Interesting. Is that going to be your party, Fred? And do you buy this narrative that there's this socialist movement that is gripping the nation?
Well, what's happening right now, at least on the Democratic side, is that you're seeing a reaction to Donald Trump. The reason why you didn't see this really gain footing from 2008 through 2016, even though there were persons here and there, was because Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi were some amazing leaders to hold this down, but it's because there was a central push and leadership, and the Republican Party at that point had not swung to where it is right now. You had the Tea Party out there, but it was considered kind of like an insurgent side piece to the main dish of the Republican Party. But since 2016, over the last 10 years, the Republican Party has moved further and further to the right. And in this iteration of Donald Trump's administration, his second run, people on the left are seeing, and Americans overall are seeing that, hey, wait a minute, the things that you said someone couldn't do, you really can do if you want to do it. So if that's the case, here are our laundry list of wishes, and we expect and we are going to elect people who will move forward with those things. And so this is a reaction very much so to Donald Trump. Now, if it's here to stay, I'm not quite sure, but I think that this is good and bad for the country. It's good because this is, again, this is we need checks and balances in our country and even within parties. But it's bad because we're seeing on both sides now, so just one side, which is the right, we're starting to see on both sides even more polarization, and that's pulling us apart at the heart of our country right as we approach our anniversary of our birthday and our anniversary, 250th anniversary of the country. Yeah.
I want to pull you both back to these Supreme Court rulings today and something important that Mick said. He was really talking most about this Lisa Cook ruling. Rick, if you're just joining us, the Supreme Court at last ruled that Lisa Cook will stay on, can stay on the job for now, even as the administration attempts to prove mortgage fraud allegations. It was the line from the Chief Justice, Rick. We talked about it in our first hour. Monetary policy should not be subject to political interference. Mick really called that into question and predicted that it would come back to haunt Republicans in years ahead. Do you agree?
Yeah, I don't agree. You know, look, we've lost our chops as a party on fiscal conservatism. And I think that this may have been the biggest gift that John Roberts could have given our party is to reflect back on what we really believe in, which is, you know, a very, very conservative fiscal policy, which, by the way, is not going to get done by the Treasury Department. They handle the fiscal policy of America, and monetary policy is the exclusive right of the Federal Reserve. And that's the way that it was set up. That's the way it's operated. And I think John Roberts just saved the day by making that point that these things are not things that should be politically dominated. I can make the case one way or another about independent agencies, but when you start printing money and you start making decisions relevant to things like interest rates and you start politicizing that, there's not a single fiscally conservative Republican I know that thinks that's a good idea.
Fascinating. Well, with all of that said, Fred, I don't know if you think the Supreme Court saved the day, but did they save Lisa Cook's job? What happens if the administration can prove, in fact, that she committed mortgage fraud? What then?
Well, I don't think they will be able to do that. Her explanations thus far have sounded quite reasonable to me, but that's not going to stop the administration from trying. The Supreme Court did save her job. And what the Supreme Court did was even beyond and more so than saving the job of Lisa Cook. It preserved capitalism as king of America. And so it was interesting that on the same day that they said that you can remove other agency heads,
yep,
you, without a problem, and it's the power, it's the purview of the executive, head of the executive branch. When it comes to our money, that should not be politicized, and we have to protect our monetary policy at all costs. Unless I'm a capitalist, and so I find that to be very interesting. That capitalism, cash, still is king and is the driver of American policy. And so I think that that's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out for the rest of the way. But as far as Cook is concerned, I think she's going to be good to go. I expect a lot of ongoing litigation, but this is where we are.
We got bipartisan capitalism going on here on Bloomberg. You gotta love it.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We're live in Washington. Kaylee's off today. I'm Joe Matthew, and glad you're joining us here on Bloomberg Radio as well. If you want to find us on YouTube, search Bloomberg Business News Live. We'll bring you right into the studio for our conversation with Elizabeth Wydra. We did hear from Lisa Cook, by the way. I don't think I've had a chance to mention it this hour. Not only heard from the president, who called this a procedural matter, but in fact, the Federal Reserve governor herself writing, today's ruling affirms a principle that has underpinned sound economic stewardship for generations. The Fed must make all its policy decisions guided by evidence and independent judgment, free from political interference. Indeed, it was the Chief Justice himself, John Roberts, who wrote, "Monetary policy should not be subject to political interference." As the court rules 5-4 that Lisa Cook can stay on the job for now. We do question what might happen if, in fact, the administration managed to prove the allegations against her. Would that be a different dynamic in the eyes of the court? Maybe not, based on what the Chief Justice writes, but we ask someone in the know with great experience when it comes to Supreme Court cases. Elizabeth Wydra, the president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, is back with us today. And Elizabeth, it's great to see you. Welcome back to Bloomberg TV and radio. How would you attempt to answer that question, knowing what we know in this ruling, if in fact the allegations against Lisa Cook were proven, would that cause be acknowledged as suitable for firing or not?
Well, I think, you know, the Supreme Court's decision today makes clear that they are giving an additional measure of protection to Fed governors that they're not giving to people who are commissioners or leaders at other independent agencies, which doesn't really have a lot of internal coherence, but they certainly seem to be giving deference to the Fed. A lot of people are noting that, you know, this court is generally very pro-big business and business interests support having a healthy, independent Federal Reserve. And so that could be one reason why they are treating it different than the Federal Trade Commission, which often works to protect individuals, consumers, workers, everyday Americans. But I think it's unclear. It's clear that the Supreme Court is saying that the Fed statutory requirements of cause apply to Lisa Cook. So she can't just be removed for no reason, that she deserves some notice and procedure in order to respond to the allegations against her. Now, if there is a determination that, you know, she has committed some wrongdoing, then presumably there would be more litigation about whether that qualifies. The allegations, of course, are mortgage fraud. She responds and says it's just, you know, simply a slight discrepancy in paperwork. So, you know, with proper notice, with proper procedure, you know, the allegations seem pretty flimsy and probably wouldn't go forward.
Really interesting. The court stopped short of clarifying that, which is why I start there with you, Elizabeth. And I'd love to hear more from you about the Slaughter case. This overturns, it's a 6-3 decision, overturns a 1935 precedent that laid the legal groundwork for the modern administrative state. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, I mentioned a couple of moments ago, said the majority, this is in her dissent, the majority abandoned the doctrine of standing behind precedents. Is that the case? Is that true?
Yes, that is certainly true. And the case you mentioned is a case called Humphrey's Executor and has become famous in sort of the conservative legal movement as something that proponents of a very strong, often unitary executive is the term they use, where the executive has incredible, extraordinary power. They have been seeking to overturn Humphrey's Executor for quite a long time. That's been a major goal of the conservative legal movement, which was achieved today, as Justice Sotomayor argues against in her dissent. And, you know, the idea is you only overturn cases that people have relied upon for decades when there's a good reason to. Justice Sotomayor certainly says there is no good reason to today. It's important to preserve the independence of FTC commissioners in the same way that it's important to preserve the importance of the Fed. The rationale between saving one and not saving the other doesn't seem to be particularly based in constitutional text and history or statutory differences. Really, it seems to be more about which agency the conservative supermajority thinks is more important to insulate from presidential interference.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, you just wonder if this leads to a massive round of firing with every administration. I know there's a lot of turnover that comes with that. But beyond some of the more obvious positions, does every president just fire everybody and start from scratch?
I think that is certainly a fear. And, you know, the idea of insulating these commissioners of these important agencies, you know, who are tasked with really protecting the American people in both economic, civil rights, all sorts of different ways. The idea of preserving their independence some way and having lengthy terms that cut across presidential terms is to have some continuity, to have some consistency, to have institutional memory, and ensure that they're not just following, you know, base political whims. Obviously, you know, they're part of the executive, but, you know, I think the concern here is that particularly in the Trump administration, when you see a lot of attacks on the civil service and the ability of government employees to, you know, act in that public interest, not necessarily just follow Trump's interests when it conflicts with the American people's interests, that's really part of the concern. But certainly, if you can, you know, fire for any reason at all, fire at will commissioners, you know, it is likely that it'll be used by presidents of both parties.
Elizabeth, I've got less than a minute left. People have been asking the question, is this an ideological court or simply a loyal one when it comes to a man named Donald Trump? Did today's rulings help to answer that question?
I don't think they fully did. I think it's unquestionably an ideological court. You see major goals of the conservative legal movement achieved this term with the absolute demolition of the Voting Rights Act, which is a tragedy for America. And today, with the overturning of protections of political appointees who are there to protect the American people.
Yeah. Elizabeth, it's great to see you. You're so smart on this stuff and glad that you could be with us today. It's on to birthright citizenship tomorrow. We might have to get Elizabeth Wydra back. She's the president of the Constitutional Accountability Center with us live on Bloomberg. Coming up, we'll talk to Michael McKee about this and Congresswoman Nicole Malliotakis next on Bloomberg.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
A few hours from now, 2.5 hours, there's a very important briefing that's going to be set for all members of Congress, including one of our next guests. We're going to be talking momentarily with Congresswoman Nicole Malliotakis, the Republican from New York, will be briefed along with all members of the House and Senate by Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Steve Witkoff. An update on Iran peace talks. This could be fascinating as we wait to learn more about the on-again, off-again talks, knowing that, in fact, the next round has been scheduled. We thought before the Supreme Court ruled this would be the top story of the day, as the president says peace talks with Iran are set to resume tomorrow in Doha. We'll park that there for now. The Supreme Court rulings really have taken over the news cycle, though the president's been posting on Truth Social about them since the SCOTUS ruled that Lisa Cook could, in fact, stay in her job, at least for now, at the Federal Reserve. And she may keep that job no matter what happens with the investigation into her alleged mortgage fraud. This, of course, runs counter to a separate ruling that made clear by the court in a 6-3 decision overturning a 1935 precedent that allows the president to essentially fire the head of any other agency. The Federal Reserve seems to be living in its own world suddenly based on these two rulings. And Michael McKee joins us with more now. Of course, he covers the Fed for us as our international economics and policy correspondent. He also happens to be really smart when it comes to the high court. And Michael, it's great to have you back. Is this what we've learned today? The Fed is simply different?
The Fed is different, according to the Supreme Court, at least. They believe that there's a tradition in the United States, is the way the decision reads, to have an independent Federal Reserve that is not caught up in politics. And that was one of the reasons that Chief Justice Roberts gave in the opinion that he wrote for allowing Lisa Cook to stay on, that letting the president fire someone at will from the Fed would take away from that independence. However, they did this as a very narrow ruling, Joe. They said that in this case, it's Lisa Cook can stay on the job while her case proceeds. And so It is possible that the president could once again say that there is allegedly wrongdoing, then give her a couple of weeks or so to respond and make her case, but then fire her anyway. So there is a way for the administration to make this worse, but does the president want to do that right now? The Supreme Court did not decide specifically that the president can't fire anybody. It's just part of the overall ruling.
Right. So did they simply tell him how to do it then, Mike? Because the Chief Justice Roberts writes, monetary policy should not be subject to political interference. So if the case presumably then can be made that there was wrongdoing, then the Fed governor can be fired for cause? Or are we going to need to test this in real time to find out?
Probably need to test this in real time. The court did say that independent Fed is a good thing for the country, but they didn't say that it has to be. It said that, you know, that she can, she should have been given, rather, an opportunity to contest the findings. That's what's at issue. Now, they did not say that she has to be convicted of anything, and they didn't rule on whether or not the president could fire her for something that allegedly happened before she became a member of the Fed. So those are outstanding questions out there, and we'll see if the president wants to pursue this, if it's enough of a rabbit hole he wants to go down.
We sure will. And of course, we're still waiting to find out what they do with the investigation into Jay Powell. So I guess we're all going to sit around here and wait. Michael, thank you. As always, he's been a busy guy today, not because of Fed news, but, well, I guess it is. It's SCOTUS news that applies to the Fed. And he's the best we have when it comes to analysis. Lisa Cook out with a statement. It's not just the president talking about this. She says, I am grateful for this decision, not for my own sake, but for the sake of the American people, whose economic well-being depends on a central bank that answers to its mission, not political intimidation. We'll find out where this goes, of course, with one more day of SCOTUS rulings, and it's going to be birthright citizenship tomorrow morning. We know that only because it's still on the docket, and tomorrow will, in fact, be the final day that opinions are released. So let's meet back here at 10 a.m. tomorrow. With a lot more to talk about. It's not the only news here in Washington, D.C. Without these rulings today, we'd probably be talking a lot about the housing bill again, as Speaker Mike Johnson, in fact, is sending it to the president today. This is the one that could have been signed last week before the president canceled the signing ceremony. But we're not clear exactly on when that's going to happen, or even if he's going to sign it. He could just let the bill sit and it would become law in 10 days now that it's been formally transferred over to the White House. We have a lot more to talk about, including this, with Congresswoman Nicole Malliotakis. As I mentioned, the Republican from New York is with us in studio today as the House gets back to business. And Congresswoman, it's great to see you on Bloomberg, as always. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
I think people are talking a lot today about what they think is going to happen. Do we know what's going to happen with this bill? Has the president said that there'll be a ceremony of some sort today or a signing?
I think we know by now with President Trump, you really never know what's going to happen.
Right.
Nobody thought that he was not going to sign it last week. But I do believe he will sign the bill. It is a very important piece of legislation that he himself had advocated for. Right. And it had broad bipartisan support. Yeah. I mean, this passed overwhelmingly and really addresses issues of supply, of access to capital, of ensuring that banks don't, you know, outbid families to an extent where they are taking too much of housing supply off the market. I think it's a good piece of legislation that will deal with the affordability. It was one of his top priorities in terms of addressing some of these affordability issues prior to the election. And I think it is it's a real win. It's an easy layup for him. So just sign it and let's try to do what we can to increase some housing supply in
this
country.
This is what you want to be talking about when you go home for your 4th of July weekend, right? When
That's
you're talking to people and marching in parades. You've got more where this came from, out with legislation, I see here, to cut capital gains taxes for seniors selling their homes. Is this something that's good for seniors to keep a couple dollars in their pocket, or might it actually inspire some seniors to move and loosen up the housing market?
I think it's a win-win here. I mean, let's be realistic about the capital gains tax exemption has not increased from the current $250,000 and $500,000 for married couple since Bill Clinton was in office. So it's been quite a while. It needs to be modernized. It was never indexed. My legislation would increase that to $1 million. It would benefit senior citizens who have lived in their homes for 25 years or more. And the idea here is that, you know, many seniors are putting their homes in a trust. And then when they pass away, their children get it. There's no tax dollars then involved either at that point. So it's not really a big cost, I don't think, to the government. We're asking the CBO for a score right now.
Okay.
But what I will say is that I do think it is exactly what you said. It'll loosen up the housing market, allow seniors who want to downsize but have been holding on to their home because they don't want to see their nest egg, all their savings and equity in their home being taxed at capital gains rates. And it'll open up that housing for younger families to be able to move in, create some economic activity in our community. I think it's a good thing. We also have legislation, by the way, in a bipartisan manner in the House Ways and Means Committee to increase the capital gains tax exemption for home sales from its current $250,000 and $500,000, doubling it. So I think that, you know, we should be doing it for everyone.
Yeah.
But if we could at least get it done for seniors now, that would be fantastic. I could see something like this going in a reconciliation package this year.
Is that the vehicle? I was going to follow up with that. You might be able to find a home for this bill.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think most tax policy would go through a reconciliation. We had so much success with the working families tax cut from the no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security, the overtime provisions, the child tax credit, the Trump savings credit. So, I mean, a lot has been used already in the first bill. So we Ways and Means, are looking at what our options are to build on that success and give more tax breaks for senior citizens, for our working families, for working Americans. And that's the idea, to keep more money in the hands of working Americans as opposed to Uncle Sam.
You were a big proponent of the Trump accounts. Those are taking effect now. Apparently, they're going to ring the stock exchange. They're going to ring the opening bell in the Oval Office. Did you see this?
I did not see
that.
They
need to put like a button next to the Diet Coke button. I don't know how they do that.
Well, look, millions of children are already enrolled in those baby accounts. Mm. And so it's not just for newborns. I mean, the idea was originally created for newborn babies, $1,000.
Right.
And you know, you get a start there, and families can invest more, so it compounds and obviously grows by the time they're 18. But now other private sector companies have done a great job being corporate citizens, saying that they'll put in some money too. So older kids, not just newborn babies from 2025, can benefit from those savings accounts. Yeah. So it is a good thing. I think in general we need to teach more fiscal responsibility, teach our young people about financial literacy. And it's one of the things I just talked about with JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon when he came to visit us on the Hill. Like, how do we bring more of this stuff into the classroom and teach young people? I think these baby savings accounts, I think, is a start.
How about that? Congresswoman, you have an important briefing, I understand, at 4 o'clock today. It's an all-members briefing from Steve Witkoff on the Iran peace talks. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have specific questions for him, but that seems like an important moment when they decide to brief the entire membership as opposed to certain committee chairs. What does that tell you about where we are in the game here? There'll be another round of peace talks tomorrow.
Well, look, I imagine that the briefing is going to be high level, but not classified, obviously. Sure. So it's going to be limitations on what we'll be learning during this call. But I think it's important for us to all get an update. And certainly members of Congress, myself included, want to know that if we're loosening any sanctions on Iran or that we're unfreezing any of their assets, that money is not going to go and fund these terrorist organizations like Hamas, like Hezbollah, and like others that have been so destructive and have murdered so many people. We also, you know, want to make sure that if that they do not have a nuclear weapon, that they're going to adhere to these inspections to ensure that they're not enriching nuclear weapon grade uranium.
Right.
So there's a lot of questions on how we're going to be able to trust Iran, because obviously they're not trustworthy. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other issues that I want to bring up on this call, it's related to the Middle East, is Turkey getting F-35 jets. I'm 100% opposed to this.
Really?
You know, Turkey is a NATO ally, but under Erdogan, they have not sanctioned Russia. Mm-hmm. They have harbored Hamas. They have interrupted counter ISIS operations. And I think that, you know, they've also called for the complete destruction of Israel. Mm. So, and not only that, they are illegally running flights of military jets above Greek islands and intimidating their neighbor, who is also a NATO ally.
Yeah.
And they've been illegally occupying Cyprus for decades now. And so I think that that's where I have already said that to the White House that I'm very opposed to this. I think it would be somebody who has aligned themselves with Russia and Iran should not have access to our premier jets and that type of intelligence.
God knows they've been asking for them. The Secretary of State is going to be in this briefing and be on this call, Marco Rubio. I don't know if he's taken the reins from J.D. Vance, but is that something you plan to talk to him about? Is that for a different forum?
Well, look, I think he just wants to overall give us an update, and the members do have a lot of questions. We have not been briefed since these negotiations have taken place, and I think that it's appropriate for him to do so. I would like for them to come in and eventually give us a classified briefing, because that's when you really find out the stuff that you can't read on Twitter, and that's obviously what members of Congress want access to.
Of course.
But I think Marco is a good friend. He's a very very smart individual. I believe he's going to go down as being the best Secretary of State that we've ever had. And I'm very proud of the work that he's doing. And I think he has the right job at the right time.
Well, we'd love to hear more to the extent that we can about all of this. You're marching in parades, Staten Island, 4th of July?
We have an old one on 4th of July.
You sure do.
It's a great parade. It's always very hot. So
it'll be 100 degrees, Congresswoman.
Of course it is. Of course.
Bail me out. We'll be sweating to the oldies here in Washington. Congresswoman Nicole Malliotakis, the Republican from New York, with us live in studio as we get things rolling on a Monday. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.